The Movie Morgue podcast is supported by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you want to learn how to support our show, please go to patreon.com/doubledocmd. And now for this week's episode. Just wash it all, wash it.
Ladies and gentlemen, assassins and wet boys, welcome to the Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I'm your host, Jess.
And I'm your co-host, Annie.
And returning friend of the show, John Donahue. Say hi, John.
I'm sorry. Also, was that wet boys thing just a joke just for me?
Yes. Yes, it was.
I really appreciate it, Jess.
For you. Night Angel Trilogy. Look it up. It's very good.
I don't know anybody else who read those books.
And today we are covering the 2019 Jonas Åkerlund film Polar, released by Netflix and shoved in our goddamn faces for like a month ago. So yeah, a little bit of context for this one. It's based on a comic book, and a comic book that was a web comic that was largely without text. And that's about it. It was shoved.
Oh,
it was kind of
text.
It was kind of shoved in our face by Netflix's marketing department because Netflix gets to decide what's popular now. And the trailers gave it kind of like a John Wick with Mads Mikkelsen kind of vibe. So I have been calling it Mads Wickelson for the last 2 weeks.
Okay.
And I don't know. Does anyone have any additional context beyond that?
Have either of you two read the webcomic?
Nope.
This is the first I'm hearing from about it.
Okay. Yeah, I have.
I believe
either.
It's also titled Polar, and I had a brief look. It's been published, I think, by Dark Horse with added dialogue.
Yes.
It actually sounds like kind of a messy creative situation.
Yeah, it is.
So I'm not going to really reflect on that too much. It's just something I wanted to note, because I think this does tie into, I think, some of the problems the film has. But yeah, so
a little
I guess,
bit of foreshadowing.
Yeah, so I guess that takes us right into the review portion here, and I'm going to go ahead and give this one a C+. There's, like, this movie needed to go back in the oven. That's just the truth of it. There's a lot of really cool things that it does, and a lot of really cool things that it tries to do, but it's very loose, and a lot of the things that it's doing kind of work in opposition to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think there is a path to thread the needle where you could make all those things kind of work together cohesively, but it is not nearly tight enough to do that.
Mm.
What about you, Annie?
You know what? I'm actually tempted to let John go.
All right, John.
After that. John, what did you think of Polar?
I'm actually going to go ahead and say just a regular CB as well. I tried to watch it a second time, and I ended up just playing Magic Arena while it was on instead. Like, I wanted to watch it and focus on it to, like, take in things, and then after the first half of the movie, I started playing Magic Cards.
Ah, that's fair. I actually watched it a second time as well, and I spent a lot more time on social media, but also I think I've probably focused a bit more because I knew which parts to skip.
Yeah.
Genuinely, the back half of this movie had a lot of parts where it's like, oh, this scene, which I didn't like and doesn't add to the movie, is 6 minutes long. I'm gonna skip that.
Yep.
And Annie, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you both have said. But for me, this movie was a D. It fails to execute its core concept, which is to say it picks up its core concept, then it puts it down again. Then it picks it up again, then it puts it down again. And, you know, doesn't really have a distinctive, clear through line. Like, it doesn't have something consistent to say. That is my overall critique of this movie. And it's partly because its screenplay is so muddled in terms of its emotional tone and narrative trajectory. So it does feel like something that needed a bit more time. We needed another draft with this one. That being said, the aesthetics of the film are really enjoyable. I like the pop art assassin aesthetic that we've seen in films really from the past 5 to 8 years, but also that stuff that comes to us from Hudson Hawk, which is, you know, a ways back. And I just really enjoyed that aesthetic. I like the character design for the younger assassins and for Mads Mikkelsen's character, the Black Kaiser. So I do think that it has some good aesthetics. I just think that the content isn't necessarily there. And that's kind of what I hope we can talk about today, because there is a lot to discuss with this movie.
Yeah, and I think that was the first question I was going to bring up as we kind of get into the technical stuff, is like, what is the biggest problem of this film? And I think it is the script and I think the overall direction. And I don't want to be too, I think, you know, ad hominem with this, but, you know, hand of the director in that, like, auteur theory. But, like, I feel like there isn't necessarily a strong vision to this. I see some things that they're trying. In particular, this is one of those things that's really fascinating about, because, like, this movie was genuinely kind of boring on a second viewing, which is fascinating because there's still so much I'm interested in. It's, like, kind of paradoxical like that. But one thing I noticed is, like, the intro sets it up where it's, like, you've got this kind of, like, because I did, like, a whole Twitter thread while I was live watching this the first time, and my initial impression was, like, this is, oh, you know, John Wick by way of, you know, Rockstar Games. And that turns out to be, like, this kind of weird slice of the pie. There's, like, these four different, like, emotional/filmic rule sets for these different factions of assassins, and like, it doesn't play out, it doesn't quite work, but I wish it did.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that almost work. One thing that I thought after the fact of having watched it is, like, it feels like, at least for the back half, they had a lot of ideas for, like, things they wanted to happen, but not a real good way of connecting them together, if that makes sense. Like, there's not, I don't think the connective tissue is good in the second half of the film.
Yeah. I actually, if I'm looking this, I'm actually gonna say I think Matt Lucas's Mr. Blood is probably one of the weakest links in the film, not because of his performance, but this feels like, here's the thing, I don't mind Matt Lucas. He does some good work. So he's definitely very pigeonholed. And I feel like this was a decision higher up the chain, because this whole, like, pallid, corpulent man-child trope that they're playing with did not work for me. And I feel like, especially with the character of Vivian, I feel like they almost set up something where he would be replaced by her, since she was demonstrably and repeatedly a much more competent manager/leader than he was. And so, like, it, especially, like, how he's introduced, he's like, you know, this is my sword, I don't know what Damocles means. And then it looks like they're going to actually, like, you know, replace him, cut off the head of the snake. And, like, you could have, especially with the Vivian storyline, like, and this is, like, me pulling a Lucy and saying, like, here's the ending I would have wanted. But, like, having her put in this position where she has to lead, but now it's too late, Mads Mikkelsen is coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, right. That's kind of what I expected they were setting up. And then they just, like, oh, no, he's the actual bad guy, I guess.
What, you didn't like the bad guy named Mr. Blood?
Blood means blood? Oh, no. It's so ominous.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad that you brought up Matt Lucas in this, because I agree that I think that his, the character of Blut is the weak point in the script for me. And it's partly because I feel like what this film is doing is mixing too many tropes together. It feels like this film put John Wick, the Red franchise, the Kingsman franchise, and Hudson Hawk from the 1990s into a blender, along with a dash of James Bond. And this is what came out. And I think the character of Blut, like, all the stuff that you've pointed out, I definitely agree with. But there's a lot of heavy overacting in the scenes with him. It feels very mannered and stylized, and I'm not sure why it's doing that. If it was a movie like Hudson Hawk, I get why it's mannered and stylized. It's doing that because it's an absurdist comedy. But in this film, like, this film doesn't feel like it knows what its tone is. There's so many tonal shifts, and they feel really kind of, like, rapid and just sort of, like, turning around on a dime. And I think Blut is a pretty good example of that.
Yeah. And I will say one thing about Matt Lucas's performance in particular here, because, like, I try to, I think, where I can, like, separate things out as much as possible, and especially not to, like, attack people personally, because, and this is one of the reasons I say I like his performance, is he's one of the people in the movie who is definitely having fun. And, like, I don't like the character, and I don't like the tropes, and I feel like he should be removed from the movie, but when he's on screen, he's having a lot of fun, and that gives a little bit of joy to some, especially some parts of the movie that are just kind of, like, really slow and empty. Yeah. So, like, when he's playing with the sword, like, that's a fun bit. It's a stupid bit, but he's like, ha, yeah, hua, oh, papa.
Or when he's real angry and he's smashing shit on his desk with a mace.
Smashing candy jars. He's a literal child.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is what Dudley grows up into. Yeah. That being said, talking about this kind of weird tonal inconsistency, I want to kind of break into, like, one of my weird takes on this movie is I feel like I believe there's kind of four different emotional threads or tones. You have Mads Mikkelsen, who operates on this kind of Batman slash John Wick emotional logic. Is, you know, he's just vengeance, he's just death, he's coming towards you, he's the Babadook. He's It Follows, but an assassin. And, yep. You know, that's kind of works. Spoilers, by the way, because we're going to get into some of those. The Millennial Assassin Squad kind of works on that, like, rock star kind of irreverent. Like, it's like this nihilistic materialism via millennials, which I actually really enjoy. Then you have Blut, who operates on literal cartoon villain logic. Like, he's Dr. Claw, but more murderous.
He definitely is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then you have... Sorry?
I was just going to say, yeah, his big plan is to murder all of his assassins so he doesn't have to pay their retirement and he can sell his murder company.
Put a pin in that because I want to come back to that, actually.
Unionize! And...
Yes. Yes, we're the blood union. You pay your dues in blood.
I mean, it would have fixed this.
And then you have Camille, who operates on this emotional note that I don't think is necessary. It's very specific, but very hard to define. It's like this single act of emotional violence. It reminds me very much of, like, something out of, like, you know, Leon the Professional or similar, where violence is not its own.
Very heavily on that.
Yeah, it's where the violence is not the act itself. It's not the interest. It is the kind of emotional process behind the act of violence. And actually, that is one of the parts that I think held up well under a second viewing, because having the subtext of every conversation they have is actually very interesting, I think, for her performance.
Yeah, yeah, no, that is.
It is, and I think she does actually a pretty good job with this. My issue is not actually with Vanessa Hudgens' acting. I want to make that very clear. I actually like her tremendously as an actress. My issue is with the writing for her. Some of the lines felt really artificial, and it was just partly because they had, like, definitive articles where they should have had something, like, a little bit more loose. When you write for an actor, you need to make sure that it's written in their voice and that it's not written to sound like poetry that they might not compose themselves. And especially when you're writing about a character that's this traumatized too. And I just found some of her lines to be kind of artificial. And that's not her fault. That's the production team.
Yeah. Like, weirdly, like, I like her performance in this, but I also feel like, weirdly, half the time I feel like they wanted Kate Micucci. I can't explain why I think that.
Yeah, I can see why you would think that. Although Kate Micucci, while she does have dark hair, brown eyes, and a kind of gamine look, is very much more in the category of quirky manic pixie dream girl, whereas Vanessa Hudgens' character in this film is much more about camouflage. She's not wearing makeup. She's wearing clothing that helps her to blend into the background. She takes photographs of animals and needs to be able to get up close to them, that sort of stuff. And even if you think about the acting choices that Hudgens makes, which I really kind of admire, she makes her body smaller. Her body posture is very closed. And in seeking to make herself smaller, in seeking to camouflage herself from the world, she oftentimes ends up doing these awkward things that draw attention to herself, like knocking things over. I really appreciated that about this character. I think that Vanessa Hudgens was the right person to pick. But I sort of understand what you're saying, Jess.
Yeah. This is fair. This is fair. So going back to those kind of four emotional threads, though, I do think you can actually kind of weave them together in like almost like a Spider-Verse kind of way. Like it's weird to describe this really kind of vague, nebulous concept of what I'm seeing in potential. But like I see them as being kind of like these different tones, not only in the language of who they are as people, but in the language of film that they have. Like, honestly, I think, like, you would actually get a lot if you change the font and the kind of introduction cutting and, like, motion graphics that you did for the introductions. Like, because, like, they all have the same, like, font and kind of energy to them. But if you introduce, for example, Blut and Black Kaiser with different kind of typographies, then I think it would do a good job of, like, kind of separating them into different worlds.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, you know, the intersection like of these worlds.
Because Sans.
Yeah. And also, like, I think also just, like, give Camille an intro, like, right at the end. Like, here's an ending note right there.
Oh,
fucking,
yeah.
Kill Duncan. Fucking
I
kill
didn't
Duncan.
Think of that. That yeah. was great.
Think
That's
of it.
A
you
great
know,
idea.
You have the
yep,
cabin.
Yep.
You're panning up slowly.
Do
you
it.
Hear the shot. And then you add Camille in, like, whatever font that you find appropriate for her.
See? I wanted that
a
ending.
Cool,
that
cool
was the ending I wanted.
Font.
Yeah. Like I said, this is why this movie frustrates me, and this is why, like,
there's bits.
Because, Annie, I was like, hey, you want to do that, you know, John Wickelson movie? And you were kind of like, you know what, Jess, watch the first 10 minutes and say if we have something to talk about. And after the first 10 minutes, I'm like, okay, we have something to talk about. And then at the end, I'm like, this is really bad, but I have stuff to talk about.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, like, it's one of those movies that's very frustrating because there are enough really great elements. And I think saying really great is not
to make
hyperbole.
Something good.
Like, there's a lot of really incredible visual stylization in front. Like, there's this, like, and it doesn't go anywhere, but there's this really weird preoccupation with the color yellow that feels very deliberate, and it doesn't do anything.
I like all the color use, honestly. It's really good. Or there's that scene where that it makes a lot more sense with the full context of the film, where, like, at one point, like, right before all the assassins show up to his house, we get a shot of Camille taking a picture of an owl, and then in the house fight, fucking Mads Mikkelsen descends out of a goddamn tree in the night, where you did not see him.
That, like, scene is so good.
Where he's some sort of night predator.
That scene is so good.
It's a very good scene.
Don't be afraid. Okay. Let me go back for a second, because I'm trying to get to, like, this really belabored point. But trust me, I'm trying to get there, okay? But I think this actually does kind of tie into the overall plots. And I think this is a case of kind of accidental genius on their part, because the storyline of why they're doing what they're doing is capital consolidation by worker exploitation by this absurd, you know, fantasy organization of assassins. Is, yes, we are valuing our stock, we are letting capital consolidate, we are doing a merger and making money by killing our employees. It's a little bit on point, like, it's a very pointed metaphor, but it's something that I think is interesting. And what kind of works, I think, for me with these kind of four layers of reality is this idea that, you know, you've got the corporate world, you've got the workers' world, you've got the personal connection world. It's this idea that these worlds don't properly intersect. and that they affect each other.
Yep.
Because you also have, I think, a little bit of element with that, with like, you know, Duncan teaching kids and stuff. Like, it seems, before we really get the subtext, that one of the things that he has is he is emotionally incapable of relating to the world because of his experiences and implicitly some forms of PTSD, although he seems to be fine with it. Like, when he brings the cookery to class, that's like, that's not just like, ha, this is funny. That's like, this is wholly inappropriate. Holy shit.
I don't know if he's fine with it because he shoots that dog.
He does. He does. He but like, in a way, it doesn't seem to be a focal point of the character. It's not about how it affects him. It's just something he deals with.
Yeah, that's fair. And it's also this kind of like pretty meh pun on John Wick and John Wick's motivation.
Yeah,
like, it's a way for the film to tell us that the Black Kaiser's motivation in this film is going to be different than John Wick's. It's not going to be about sentimentality or revenge. It's going to be about something else.
Except it's not.
Yeah.
Except it's not.
Here's the thing I'll say. I think that scene, I think that whole sequence can be cut, and I think it would make the film better. But I will say there is a single brilliant cut in that sequence. Is the cut directly out of the flashback, you know, nightmare sequence into the shot. Like, that is a very clean cut. And it takes you a second to realize what happens. And I actually really like that, even if I don't like seeing a dog get hurt and I don't like the place of the scene in the movie. I just think technically that is a very well executed edit and scene. But yeah, and also, like, if you wanted to do that, I could also see, and you could make Bloot work if you, like, played into this idea a little bit more and had, like, a fifth layer where, like, a mega corporation was going to roll him over if he didn't deliver on his promises. Because that's one of the huge weaknesses of this film, is Bloot as a villain and Vivian, Miss Hudgens, you're confusing me. I'm so sorry. Too many V names. But Vivian, I think, also by extension, is like, I've never seen a movie where so many villains have so many opportunities to kill the protagonist. this is like every bad Bond cliche ever.
Yeah.
And it really kind of kills any dramatic stake where it's like, okay, cool. Like, here's the thing, like, it's on the goddamn poster. We know what, you know, he can do. So, like, you really just not surprised at all when he gets strung up. You're like, there is no risk that he's going to die. You know he's going to lose an eye. And so that torture sequence is 6 minutes long. Why?
You didn't even need to have a torture sequence, honestly.
That's the thing. Like, it's neither mild enough to be, like, inoffensive or, you know, like, extreme enough to be notable in its own right. So it just kind of wastes screen time.
Yeah, but there's a lot of stuff throughout the screenplay. I think there's a lot of actually needless cruelty just throughout the movie that doesn't really have a point. Like, it doesn't really articulate anything. It doesn't have anything to say. I think that was actually what bugged me the most about this. On top of, there's a lot of fat phobia in this screenplay.
You're talking about the last safe house.
But also Bloot a little bit.
Yeah, also.
Yes, Bloot, but also the guy at the safe house, and then also the drug dealer. So this is not just happening once or twice. This is happening three times, which tells us that it's very intentional. It's very much a part of the design of the story. And the way that the camera focuses on their bodies as violence is being done to their bodies is particularly disturbing. Their bodies are made into jokes. What happens to them is made into a joke. No. No, thank you. You know, not only is that something that I believe is objectionable and wrong, but it also doesn't advance the story in any way other than to say that fat people in this film's view deserve to die, deserve the cruelty, deserve to have their bodies looked at with a kind of mocking gaze. No. No thanks. And then there's the way that the film portrays Cindy. Cindy is framed most in relationship to her body parts. I actually went through the movie and looked at the shots of her, and most of the shots are of her boobs, of her legs, of her butt, and there's all the shots of her from behind, shots that are specifically looking up her crotch. I'm all for presenting women characters who are traumatized but also very sexual in film. I think there has to be a space for that. It's an important story to talk about because it's a human story, and there are a lot of women who empathize with that. But at the same time, there has to be a way to tell that story visually that is not reducing women characters to their body parts. And yeah, I really don't like the way this film tries to tell Cindy's story. I don't think it adds anything to her narrative, and I don't think it particularly adds dimension to her character. And I think this gets at one of the major issues that we've been talking about. Like, we've discussed narrative storytelling and how this film fails to do that. But one of the major issues that I see in this film, which I think the previous two examples I've cited stand in for, is that this film is not good at doing visual storytelling. It does not want to tell us a story about how trauma motivates action through visual means. It wants the audience to participate in transgressive acts of looking. It's much more interested in voyeurism than it is in visual storytelling. And that might be part of what pulls people out of this movie, and maybe even kind of makes them be like, oh, what is this doing? Maybe I should just fast forward.
It also really drags, like, really badly, especially with the repetition. The fun continues tomorrow, Mr. Vizsla. It's like, no, you're emphasizing how long the scene is taking.
Also, he doesn't do anything new. Like, I don't want to be that dude yeah. who's commenting on the creativity of the torturer, but also yeah. I'm going to be that dude because, like, at least give me something, a new visual to work with. But no, it's the same tool. He does the same thing. He's just like, oh, I'm going to cut you with a knife a bit. Now I'm going to leave the room.
Now I'm going to use some pliers. Ooh, I'm going to pull
it's
out your
tooth. It's a lot of stuff that, like, maybe younger kids, like high school kids, might find to be kind of like edgy and stuff, but it's not, it's essentially just aesthetics without content. And again, that really bugs me.
I mean, yeah. That's kind of blute though. Like, maybe if it was shorter, it could have worked. It's like, I'm going to torture you with all these creative implements, and then he just uses two. Maybe that could have been a thing, but no, they don't do that.
Yeah, and also the second is like, you broke my knife. It's like, yes, okay, Chekhov's gun. That's how he escapes, because we know he's going to escape. I will say, I like the escape sequence after that. I think that's a really fun action sequence.
I also liked that.
It's
yeah,
just like this really grueling slog.
I think it wasn't executed quite as well as it could have been. But
No. And
yeah.
It also, like, this is one of those, like, really, like, I don't like to be the plot hole girl. Like, I don't like this kind of CinemaSins style critique.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, fuck off CinemaSins. But it's one of those things where it's like, you got him, kill him. Like, it's one of those cases where, and like, oh, you know, he just, like, he's weakened and battered and, like, a broken person, and he's just flinging this fucking fire extinguisher like it's a basketball. And it's like, no, those things are heavy. You ever try and, like, lift one of those off the wall? That shit's heavy.
Yeah, but you're no offense, but you're not the Black Kaiser.
No, I am not.
You're not an old man who's been shot to shit and is full of shrapnel and has been stabbed several times recently, so you're bleeding out all over the floor.
Yes, that was the other, like, real big plot hole thing that I was gonna, like, nitpick about, is, like, the man would have died of infection, straight up. Like, he's unwashed and left on the floor for 4 days.
I mean, counterpoint, he can teleport, so...
Yeah, and that's
he teleports across that lake.
Now, here's the thing. Here's where you go if you want to make Blute like this actually scary villain. Here's what you do: you do that 4 day torture sequence, and you can keep your repetition, but you also end each day with him dressing his wounds and like being like a creepy nurse.
Yeah, yeah.
that would add something to it.
And it's also, like, it's telling the story, right? It's about the company that does harm, but also offers you a bomb at the end of the day so that you stay with them. So it's, like, actually doing something in the story. Yeah. Yeah.
And see, this is why it's so frustrating. Everything that I want to bitch about is not that hard to fix.
Did you all feel like this had anything to say about retirement? Or, like, what it's like to be an older guy as a spy? Because I feel like Red kind of did that. And this movie, not so much. Apart from that scene with the doctor with the embarrassing prostate exam.
Yeah, starting with a butt joke. That's, John, if you can respond to this first, because I have a formulated thought.
I don't know if it did so much beyond, like, hey, the general, like, hey, if you murder a bunch of people for money, maybe you won't be too mentally healthy at the end of the day. Maybe you should see somebody about that, dog.
Okay. So I actually think it does have a point, and it may be emergent. It may not be a deliberate choice that they're making, but it's not through the Black Kaiser. It's not through Mads Mikkelsen. It's through the Millennial Hit Squad. Because they are actively participating in and earning short-term profit in behavior that is against the interest of the kind of intersections of groups that they belong to, these assassins, this organization. Yeah. They are sabotaging their own future. And, like, it's something to say, like, yeah, for, I think, you know, Mads Mikkelsen, it's not really something I think that factors in. But for these guys, it's like, live by the gun, die by the gun. And that's absolutely what happens to them. And I think it kind of plays into, like I've described them as having this kind of, like, materialistic millennial nihilism. And I think that does kind of play into this kind of economic figure, like, you and people like you and I, is it's unlikely we're ever going to be able to retire.
Yeah.
So I do think it has something to say on that front. Point. I just don't think it's where we would normally expect to find it in a movie like this.
Oh, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we talk about the Millennial Kit Squad for a second? Because I actually really like them.
Yeah.
Interesting. First of all, Faye Wren as Hilde. Hashtag goals. I can say that on the podcast now. I can say that on the podcast now. You have no idea, audience, how long I have been frustrated by that. Lizzie, like, yes, she's very beautiful and she performs very well in this script. And inside I'm screaming, like, I want to look like that. She's so pretty. Oh my God. So yeah, this is a peek inside the mind of Jess. but I love how they have, like, this personality and this color to them. That's just really fun. I actually love Alexei and how, like, pathetic he is. Like, he's kind of, like, the weakest of the bunch. But also, there's, like, some interesting stuff going on. And, like, I really do feel comfortable calling them the Millennial Hit Squad because they seem to kind of embody a lot of cultural changes or, like, shifts that we're seeing in spread kind of through, you know, social media and also, like, you know, millennials rising up. Because millennials are, like, up to 40 now, okay? Like, we're adults, we're working, and we're never going to retire, and it's sad. But that being said, you look at this and you get stuff like, you know, you've got that kind of economic anxiety about retiring, you've got that kind of self-destructive nihilism to them. But also, within that, there's a little bit of, like, sexual liberation. But also, what I think is interesting is they're kind... They have, like, kind of this emotional support structure for each other. And it's very little bits here and there. And I don't think it really constitutes anything healthy or that I could, like, point to and say, like, this is, like, a realistic or, like, a naturalistic or thematically cohesive version of, like, no, this is the point, is they're good to each other and so on. But there's these little moments that's like, hey, let's go get waffles, you're paying, or the whole, like, you know, like, she's dead. Like, they kind of have these very small moments of taking care of each other. And that feels like something that's part of the culture of our generation where it's like, hey, you okay? It's like, we recognize the kind of difficulty and trauma that we go through every day. And, you know, we like to check in. We like to do what little things we can. Also, it's really weird that we opened this movie with killing Anthony Scaramucci. It's just really weird.
Yeah, as soon as I saw Johnny Knoxville in that first sequence, I was kind of like, I don't really know where this is going. I kind of feel like it could be going in a Jackass direction, as in the movies, and I'm not sure that I'm going to like that. How did you all feel about this opening sequence? Did that grab your attention? Did that make you feel like, hey, yes, let's go, I'm ready?
A little bit. I had some reservations. Because it's opening with, like, blowjob party at the mansion, like, you know, billionaire fail son, whatever. But one thing I did see in it, and, like, there's also some, this early in the film, I feel like there was some, like, weird disappointment. Because I also feel like what it set up almost was, like, initially I thought, oh, are these competing assassins?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Which
as well.
I thought would have been fun.
It would have been fun.
Yeah, I also I really like the fucking Dancing in September bit, like, especially like there's a stylistic divergence from the film that I don't think really comes back. Like, that is, I think, the most millennial the Millennial Hit Squad is like when they have the fucking karaoke ball in the helicopter. I love that. It's such a fun, and like, I love that they enjoy their job. I really do.
And they're good at it. They got, like, they got a system down.
Yeah. And although I will say, like, this is one of those things where, like, my inner, like, movie nitpicker comes on. It's like, why not just shoot the guy? You've got him in the open. Just shoot him.
They
but
like
I guess...
sure.
Yeah, I guess Cindy likes the
death blow. Well, it's an introduction for all the characters. Like, that's how that part of the structure of the narrative works. It's introducing Cindy as the sexy one. It's introducing Hilda as the sort of, like, head of the squad. It's introducing Facundo as the sniper, as the kind of, like, man off the scene. And what is Alexi doing during that whole scene?
He just walks up with a gun and does nothing.
No, okay. he throws a dumbbell.
Yeah. Again, introducing Alexi's character quite well.
Also, Carl, who waits in the car.
Carl. I think Carl's the one who does the emotional support in the serial killer's den.
He does, yeah.
Yeah, I like Carl. Carl's a nice guy. Carl doesn't deserve the rest of them.
He doesn't. He's also played by Robert Mayer, who is the guy from the Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, I know. I love him.
About.
Yeah.
Which I was like, aw, it's nice to see him getting work.
Yeah.
Also, I accidentally read some stuff from the comic, and now I'm extremely angry because Damocles has a motto that didn't make it into the movie that's very good.
What's the motto?
What is it?
We are a sword against the neck of the world.
That's really fucking good.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's
Why
good.
Why is that not in the movie?
I'm also going to make a very sideways reference. Because your girl has been transitioning, and there is an album that I want to shout out, an EP by Left at London. Transgender Street Volume, Transgender Street Legends Volume 1. And she has a sword to her neck in the album art. Like, I just wanted to make that. I'm not talking about the film at all. It's just the imagery was, like, specifically evoked that, and I like it. Back to you, John.
But, yeah, like, that makes a lot of sense for what they do. It's a good motto. It ties into the company name. It's probably on business cards. I'm guessing they have business cards. The only reason I can guess that it wouldn't be in the movie is that the way they've portrayed Bloot is it wouldn't sound good for him to say.
No. How is he supposed to carry that line off? That is not a line for Bloot. That's a line for, like, Jeremy Irons or something.
Or Vivian.
You know? Yeah, Vivian could say that, but, like, Vivian isn't in the role where she's selling the company.
That's part of what I mean, yeah. I mean, like, that's something that the head boss says.
Yeah, like, Vivian kind of interests me here because, like, it really feels like there is this kind of beleaguered feminist message to where her character is coming from. Is she is supremely confident. She's apparently at least, she's apparently gay or at least bisexual. You know, she's enjoying her time. She's licking strippers.
Yeah,
you know, that's not
she was
having
fun in that club.
But not only that, but like she is a very competent, very well-presented woman who is constantly overridden by a literal man-child.
Yep. Yep.
But who got like, there for because who got there because his dad founded the company, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, he got there because of like aristocratic privilege.
Also, it's really weird that there's a hereditary birthmark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just a weird choice. But
it is a weird choice, and it also plays into a sort of like he's being constructed as a Habsburg. Like that's what's going on with that sequence. So like there is some stuff going on with that that's not quite
now, sure. But that being said, like I feel like you have this Rube Goldberg machine set up to kind of take her in that direction, and then they just never set it off. They just leave it in the room.
Yeah, no, like the way her character is written, at least like for a bit, is that she doesn't go to that meeting. She just drives away and lets him come. And then shows up later and says, I was picking up the girl for you. Here she is.
Yeah.
Please don't murder me.
No, that would be great. Like, although I prefer, I think, my version where she is the tragic villain who is more competent than Blut. Because the other thing I also feel is after the brutal slog, and especially after he, like, waves his machine gun fingers around, I'm really expecting to see, like, this kind of final confrontation. And he just walks right up to Blut and cuts his head off. There's Blut has a gun! Like, there's no resistance, and it's not satisfying. So I think to have this thing where, like, Blut's dead and she's trying to offer him up and say it's done, and he's just like, you know, I'm sorry, Vivian, I know we're friends, but you fucked me, and I have to secure my retirement. Like, yeah. I think that would be more fun. Because, like, and ultimately, like, it's hard to say, like, oh, you know, this woman character should have a tragic end, but, like, I like her. And I don't think that would be a disservice to her performance or to her character.
And I think it's also okay to have women characters who have complicated stories, like complicated endings that are, I don't know, sort of tragic. Like Catherine Winnick can pull that off. She's great in Vikings. She had the chops to do this, and I'm not really sure why she wasn't given more of that room to tell that story.
Also, I'm going to say this, that fucking machine gun fingers scene was boring as fuck.
Yeah. And it's in every goddamn trailer.
It is.
And it's on all the posters.
Also, another step back from the comic, because I was looking through the comic, and that takes place at a goddamn church in the comic.
Oh, that would have been interesting.
Yeah. See, the thing is, and like, another reason that it fucks up is like, there's just this, first of all, it's built up like it's going to be a much longer sequence. There's him getting like the arsenal. It's like, you know, we need more gun sequence basically.
Yeah.
And then you have this whole army of stormtroopers walk up to him and they don't get a single shot off. It's incredibly disappointing. Like I was honestly expecting him, especially given the setup time he had, I was honestly expecting him to have to like retreat through bulkheads and have multiple setups and stuff and have like this really thrilling action sequence. Instead, he just waves his magic hands and they all die. And then Vivian looks at him and she's a little sad because she fucked up, even though her character fell apart and she was just a smug bitch. She's like, I'm sorry, we got to kill you. You fucked up.
Yeah, you fucked up. And yeah, you fucked up real bad. Despite the fact that I have been telling Mr. Blood to fucking pay you your goddamn money the entire last hour and a half of this movie.
Oh, can I actually say, I want to cut back to an earlier sequence for a moment. I love the assassination of the big guy, the big Mexican guy. Specifically because, like, it does, I think, kind of show these different worlds that these people are operating in. Because one of the things I contrast the Millennial Squad with the Black Kaiser is he gets down and dirty. He's very tactical and, like, very much like, you know, like, kind of like SOCOM operating manual. Where it's like, okay, cool. He sets up, he prepares, he sets up ambushes multiple times. He's lying on the floor so he has a low profile, you know. He checks for things like it's a fun little assassination sequence. even though like there is that unnecessary cruelty, and but I also really like the kind of cleverness of this. He's like, okay, I can start the job now. Okay, cool. Then he sends the picture. I'm done. I'm leaving. Like, I really like that moment. That feels very snappy. And it really sets up this hyper-competence of the character because, like, that is one thing. Is, like, the Black Kaiser is the world's most feared assassin. And setting that up is important, but also it's kind of betrayed by the movies because he is the world's most deadly assassin and no one fucking respects him for some goddamn reason.
I don't think the Millennial Hit Squad even fucking knows who he is.
No, they don't seem to.
It also seems like he knows who they are.
Yeah.
Because he knows the blow time move. Like, this really frustrating thing is, I think filmically, we are shown as an audience that, yes, he is the deadliest hitman in the world. He is extremely competent. He descends out of a tree like an owl, like John said. That scene is fucking great. But no one in the movie fucking respects him, and that's where all these problems come from.
I mean, Vivian does until the last half hour of the movie needs her to forget that she respects him.
Yeah. I'm also... and she had an out, too. It's like, you know, never... You better not have had any part. I think it, what was the line again? It was like, you know,
if
you better
I find
pray you
out
had
you've
no,
had any, any
yeah, you
if
better
I
pray
find
you
out
weren't
you've had
you didn't have
any part
in this,
of this.
Don't ever contact me again.
Yeah.
I think it's also implied that they fucked. Like just
maybe
not explicitly, but like they seem to have a lot of history.
They do, but it could, that also could be that she was just his handler for a long time. But also, he's not averse to one-night stands. So who the fuck knows?
Yeah, I just I don't think, like I said, I don't think there's anything specifically pointed to that. But that's the kind of trope that I feel plays into this kind of genre. So it feels natural, even if I don't necessarily like. I think the impulses and underlying, like, you know, sociopolitical thought that leads me there. It's like it feels natural. It follows. It reads for me, at least.
I mean, she did fuck that other random old man in the bar who
you mean
stabbed
Richard Dreyfuss?
Yes,
the Richard Dreyfuss cameo in this. Like when I saw that, I was just like, "What the hell? This has just gotten weird." Like first Johnny Knoxville, now we've got Richard Dreyfuss. Like who's next? Judi Dench.
I would love Judi Dench to show up in this movie.
I would have loved a cameo from her as well. It was just...
No, Judi Dench just shows crazy. Up and shoots the Black Kaiser in the head and says, "That's for killing my daughter." There we go. There's another ending.
There we go.
Because this is the other thing also that I think is like... I think I want Camille to kill him. First of all, because I don't like the really, really hollow fucking sequel hook. It's like, oh, we can go find the people who gave me the bad information that led me to go. Like, that's actually, I think, a really disappointing emotional beat is when it's just like, oh, I didn't mean to kill your father. It's like, no, own it, bitch.
I think what he was trying to say is I didn't mean to kill all of your siblings.
That's possible, but.
But I don't know how that's because of bad information. That's because you couldn't shoot right, Mads.
It's like, it's not elaborated enough to really, like, tilt that one way or the other. But I think, ultimately, like, he doesn't kind of confront the emotional reality of, like, yeah, your job is to kill people. Because that's kind of one of the threads he's playing with. Like, the flashbacks when he's talking to the kids is like, you know, they burned them. Oh, you know, summer clothes, lots of white and red. It's like, I really like that sequence, even though, like, there's some, like, especially the whole, like, oh, if they're alive, they burn the wife, too. Like, that's probably some racist-ass shit I don't want to deal with. But, like, this whole thing where he relates to the world through killing is, I think, this kind of fascinating thread that they don't tug on at all. And so, like, and especially because, like, him sitting there with her with a gun on him is supposed to be this real moment of emotional vulnerability. And one of the things I think is strong in the performance, not necessarily the script, is that he is completely accepting and open. He's like, yeah, I do this. This is who I am. I killed your family. I'm sorry. I tried to help, but it obviously didn't work. And, like, having an emotional out, having that kind of, like, oh, I got bad information. And that says, like, John, you offered that scenario where it's like, oh, I didn't mean to kill the entire family. That didn't occur to me as a possibility, but the way I read that was like, oh, your father wasn't the target. Or, you know, your family wasn't the target. So, like, saying, like, no, here's what your dad did, here's why he died, I'm just the tool, I think would have been a much more raw and emotional kind of beat for her to confront. And I want her to kill him. Because one thing, if she kills him, this makes the Richard Dreyfuss cameo foreshadowing, because the only thing that kills him is betrayal by those he trusts. He doesn't trust Vivian. He doesn't trust Blute. He definitely doesn't trust the fucking Millennial Squad. He has their fucking number. But Richard Dreyfuss, as Porter, he's like, old friend, I need this, this, and this. You get a drink. No, I'm not drinking. You consent to have one drink with a dying man. Like, that kind of betrayal by that which he actually trusts being his downfall, I think would be incredibly appropriate. Because it would also play into Vivian's prophecy, is you've become sentimental. Which is blatantly untrue, because he wins.
Yeah. Sentiment isn't a dagger in his back, because it does, like, I mean, maybe it is, but, like, it, he's so much better than everybody else on the field that it doesn't matter.
I'm just upset again, because, like, this movie is so easy to fix.
Yeah, I think, though, that they didn't want to fix it. I read a couple interviews with the director and with Victor Santos, who wrote the comics. And Santos said, you know, like, Mads Mikkelsen was the ideal person that I wanted to play this role, because the character that he's playing is neither good nor bad. He falls somewhere in between those two things. And that little quote from the interview has really kind of stuck with me. Like, I do think that this film plays with the moral ambiguities of this character, but he is a bad person. He has done bad things.
Yeah.
And for the author of this comic to not recognize that, and for the director to say, you know, Mads Mikkelsen has executed that vision properly, there is a serious problem with the directorial direction that this film is taking, that suggests there's not really a grasp of what the material is doing, and that really kind of bugs me.
Yeah, when you say that, that immediately strikes me, because my guttural reaction to that is, no, Mads Mikkelsen is not a good/bad person. He is a monster trying to be a man.
Exactly. Yeah.
That is literally what is on the screen. Like, death of the author here, because the author doesn't have a fucking clue. I'm fucking sorry, Victor Santos. Like, I gave you the benefit of the doubt because I haven't read your comment, but dude.
I know, right?
Dude.
Yeah.
It's like, there's so many cases of this, like, where, like, a creative, like, an author or a director or something will stumble into something very real and powerful. And I'm not saying that, like, you know, the monster trying to be the man is necessarily the most nuanced or interesting or novel kind of idea, but, like, there is absolutely resonance with that idea. There is absolutely so much in the text to support that. And when you tell me that that was an accident, that really undercuts my faith in you as a creative, and especially, like, as a directorial force. So, like, that, like, knowing that cuts that from me. Like, honestly, I'm going to go down to a C-. Like, this genuinely affects my read of the film to hear that they think it was well executed. Because my initial thought was, like, oh, could they not get actors back for reshoots or something? Because my comment initially was like, this needed another hour or two in the oven. Like, this just needs a little bit more polish and some rewrites. And it's so easy to fix. But apparently, they got some jackasses at the wheel.
Yeah, and, you know, granted, like, the read that Victor Santos gave was during the production as well. So I'm not sure if it's the finished product, but he saw the product while it was being made. It sounds like. So I do want to let you know about that. But, yeah, it just
That mitigates it a little bit, but
like,
it
feels like they don't have a grasp of the material and what this material is doing, especially in an environment that is so permeated with these sort of spy who came in from the cold stories. Like, if you think about the past 10 years, we've had John Wick, we've got the Red movies, we've got Kingsman, we've got Atomic Blonde. There's so many stories that people are trying to tell about spies and the sort of like emotional intricacies of espionage and, you know, punning on violence and all this stuff. And Polar ultimately just kind of fails to say something new in a very definitive way. Which, yeah, I think that's what's bugging me the most.
I mean, it might have been good before, like, it might have been all right if it came, if something like this had come out before we started getting so many much better made movies about this. Honestly, like,
yeah, if this came out, like, let's say 7 years ago, let's 2012. I think in 2012, this would have been a pretty good, fairly novel film.
Yeah, I feel like if this had come out in 2012, this becomes a kind of genre definer. But instead, it's just sort of a catch-all for the genre, which is sort of fascinating. It makes me glad that John Wick is what we started out with. Do we know what?
Yeah, I have a question for you, Annie. Do you know how long this has been in production for? Because you've been looking over some of the in-production stuff, and I knew nothing about this until, like, a month ago.
I actually don't know that.
Okay. Because, like, and this is Netflix, so I really suspect this hasn't been in development that long. So it does, I think, feel reactionary to this crop of movies that we're talking about right now. But, like, you know, you do get cases where it's like, oh, this was in production hell for 9 years. This is, I don't think, the case. But, like, I just would like to make sure.
Oh, boy. Okay, so, So I looked this up. And, I mean, essentially the film was announced in October of 2014. And they had a script by Jason Rothwell, which was out there. Mads Mikkelsen signed on in 2017. So I'm not sure what happens between 2014 and 2017. Maybe that's how long it took to draft the script. I don't know.
Maybe. That means principal photography sometime in the last year.
Yeah, 2018.
Pretty much. So, yeah, no, it feels really rushed.
Yeah, which is odd because,
like, that's one thing.
Not.
Like, the script is just sitting there. Yeah, it's... I don't know. I really don't know. And that really sours me on the whole thing.
The film soundtrack is by Deadmau5.
Oh, you didn't know that? I actually did like the soundtrack to this.
Yeah. I think the sound was good.
I actually really liked a lot of the choices that they were making. I just didn't know it was by Deadmau5.
Yeah. I think that's also probably one of the reasons they wanted to push out is like, yeah, here's Deadmau5 gets to do a movie soundtrack. And like that is enough, I think, to sell a movie to a bunch of people. Especially like with this kind of low investment as being on Netflix. And I think that's also something we want to talk about very briefly is what the Netflix format does for you, because this movie is not competing with John Wick, because you're not paying to see this in theaters. No one is seeing this in theaters. It might have opened in a select few just because, but like that's not where they make the money. This is something that you see without paying. You pay for it. You pay for your Netflix account, obviously. Unless, you know, you're stealing it from an ex or something. But you're paying this very small amount, and they're hoping that a lot of people see it to justify the investment. That people go, ooh, Polar, what's this? Mads Mikkelsen, ooh, what's this? So it occupies a very different space than a lot of these contemporaries that we're kind of lumping it in with. This is kind of like a direct-to-video almost.
Yeah, a little...
So, like, we are entering this new space, I think, in the economics of film, where this is this novel format and, I guess, release vector that does change, I think, the expectations of film. Because I think when you look at, like, the direct-to-video era, a lot of that relied on the consumer being ill-informed It's like, oh, Aladdin 2. I loved Aladdin. Let's buy that. Or let's rent that from Blockbuster. My kid loved that. Whereas this is, you know, it's like, oh, I love this guy. Oh, he's doing this movie. Oh, I hear it's kind of weird. It's like, you know, the reviews aren't great, but it doesn't cost me anything. So I guess I'll check it out anyways.
Yeah, and this actually brings me to something I wanted to talk about with regards to Netflix. Because, you know, we've talked a lot on the podcast about how we think there needs to be room for films that are, you know, not totally getting all the elements of their story right or failing to do some things. And how we kind of see that going away in this new era of heavily studio-produced blockbusters, which are very formulaic. And Netflix has kind of become this space in which people are able to get contracts for movies and to make movies that might not succeed in a studio, that might not succeed if they were released in theaters, which I think is an important space to have, right? But one of my concerns that I think Polar and Bird Box have both brought to the forefront of my mind is, what if Netflix becomes the place where B and C movies are made? Like, what if this is the only space where that happens? Because then I think you get something that's a little bit more akin to The Asylum, where, you know, like, they were making knockoff movies of, like, major blockbusters and stuff. Because, like, I want there to be movies that are executing concepts at different levels of skill. I want there to be room for people to experiment. But I also don't want the space for that experimentation to be siloed off.
I'm going to be honest, I haven't watched a ton of Netflix original things that aren't Marvel, apart from maybe a couple of anime, which I don't think super count for this, so I'm a bad person to ask for that one, to be honest. Sorry.
Okay, here's what I will say. I think that their feature production is a little weak, and I don't know what they've done so far as studios, if like they have a Netflix production studios or if they're kind of contracting out to cheaper production houses or whatever. I don't know the details, and I'm not going to comment on that, but their original series are kind of hit and miss, but they have some real fucking bangers in there, you know. Haunted House. So I don't think it's necessarily fair to characterize it as like Netflix is this kind of like schlocky Asylum thing. Whereas not yet. If they continue releasing stuff like Polar and like that's their original film lineup, then sure. But they have done like some interesting documentaries, some very good series, some not so good series, some reality TV. There's a whole big mixed bag. And I think if we're focusing specifically on their features, I think we have some issues, but also we're checking out Velvet Buzzsaw next week, and we're really excited about that one. So, you know, they got the fucking Nightcrawler guy. Both the Nightcrawler guys, you know, the director and the star. Yeah. So, like, I don't know that there necessarily is this kind of cohesive narrative of what they are, or that we can necessarily extrapolate from this film. I see the concern, but it also seems that one thing that I really like about Netflix as a distributor, and I'm against monopolies, you know, I think Hulu needs to step up, Amazon Prime needs to step up, and like, I think Amazon Prime has American Gods and stuff, and I think they're going to have Good Omens, so like, but in like this feature film, this kind of new direct-to-video battleground for film, one thing I really like is because a lot of the overhead and distribution, and especially marketing, because Netflix didn't have to pay shit to get me to watch this. They just had to plug it into the algorithm so the trailer played when I opened Netflix. That's all they had to do. I don't like them having monopoly. I don't like that they can do that. But having it, using those tools, allows them to take risk like this. Right,
yeah.
Because, like, this is a risk, and it kind of doesn't pay off. But at the same time, if you had to run this through the same filters that John Wick had to run through, if you had to run through the whole hoops, I don't think we get this movie. And there are interesting things about this movie. And so, like, this is something we've been bitching about, is like the B movie has disappeared and movies are no longer allowed to fail. We have enough metrics, we have enough focus testing that it's very difficult to make a movie that is worse than boring. And boring is still enough to, you know, like, earn, like, you know, 100 mil domestic and like 50 foreign. So, like, this movie is interesting and daring in some ways, and it doesn't pay off. I'll admit that much. It doesn't pay off. It does not stick the landing. But that, I think, was kind of my ultimate read on this movie, is it's almost great. And if they had, if this risk had paid off, if they had different creatives in charge of it, maybe, or, like, if they had, like, you know, a editorial or directorial force that was, like, more willing to butt heads with the comic writer, like, this could be a really great film. And I genuinely feel that, like, it would not take much to make this a really great film. And so they took a risk and it didn't pay off, and I'm happy that that can happen today, because I really feel like 5 years ago that had stopped happening.
I'm pretty sure it had, so...
Yeah, and I think that's the thing about the B movie. Like, you do raise a really good point, because we talk about this all the time, about the inability for films to fail. But I think the other thing that's important to mention in that is that in order to have B movies, you also need C and D range movies. And that's kind of what we got here. If we can see some more, you know, like, Netflix feature films that are of a little bit higher quality, I think that would be a really good thing. And we'll see with Velvet Buzzsaw, like, who knows? But again, in order to have that range, yeah, you have to have some things that just don't quite pull off their concept. So, yeah.
Yeah, like, I'm not satisfied with the end product, but I am glad it exists. Because here's the thing. This is how you sell this movie to me. Mads Mikkelsen is John Wick. I want to watch that movie. I know it's not going to be as good as John Wick, but this is still something that's like, oh, this sounds really cool. And I don't think that really comes out of the Hollywood system. Not today. Like, genuinely, I think, like, if you had to take that concept and sell it through Hollywood, it would absolutely be, like, John Wick, but they have to add this emotional twist, and they sell it more to boomers, and it's about trying to have a quiet retirement, and he likes artisanal coffees and shit.
Yeah.
And he would definitely have, like, the relationship with Camille would actually, like, they'd take away the moral ambiguity and the darkness to it, and she'd be, like, the cute neighbor girl who he ends up, like, with this weird paternal relationship with, and they end up banging. And also, she is actually played by Kate Miguchi in this, because she has a ukulele. Like, that's what happens when you take this movie and you run it through Hollywood.
Yeah.
That was so accurate.
So I'm glad that this is this gross, yeah, and, like, unsatisfying film, because, for fuck's sake, it's something to, yeah, talk about.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want Mads Mikkelsen to end up being Liam Neeson.
Yeah, I mean, Liam Neeson has been the face of white vigilantism along with, you know, people like Bruce Willis for a while. So, no, I think we want to see different roles from him. And hopefully, you know, we won't see the same behaviors that Liam Neeson has engaged in that we've all learned about in the past week.
So, I think that's kind of my final thought, is, like, you could have fixed this and, you know, give me a shot in the chair. But that being said, I'm glad they took a fucking risk.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's us. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been The Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I've been your host, Jess.
And I've been your co-host, Annie.
And you guys can follow the podcast on Twitter at MovieMorgueCast or on Facebook at MovieMorguePodcast. You can follow me on Twitter at DoubleDocMD and at Twitch.tv with the same URL. I play video games 5 days a week, and yeah. Annie, where can people find you and your work?
People can always find me on Twitter. I'm at Lights and Music, and that's Lights, E-N, Music, all one word, no caps. Come by and visit.
Pictures of her dog. Beautiful dog. Lovely boy. Farts like a maniac. And John, do you have anything that you want to plug, or are you going to stick with that social recluse line?
You can't find me on the internet, but you... Well, actually, no, I beat that game today, so you will also will not be able to find me in the Keyblade Graveyard.
Anyways, it's been a pleasure having you on, John. Thank you so much. If you guys like what we do, first of all, you're already supporting us by listening, and we appreciate that immensely. Second of all, if you want to go a step further, please tell your friends. That is the number one thing that you can do. is like, hey, you want to hear these nerds talk about movies? They're really fun. That is the number one thing you guys can do for us. But if you want to go further than that, if you want to, other things you can do, you can review us on iTunes, you can review us on Facebook, you can tweet and retweet us, you can join our Discord where we continue these conversations about these movies after the episode comes out. Because I tell you, 5 minutes after we're done recording, I'm going to go, we didn't talk about this thing. And that's how things kind of continue. We like having these continuous lives. And that's the thing. Once we put our thoughts down, they're not set in stone.
No,
like, we can learn things, or we can discuss, like, our perspectives change. We have absolutely revisited movies and, like, change our thoughts on them. And so, like, yeah, sure, come argue with us. That's fine, too. And if you want to keep us in, you know, server space and celluloid, and if you want to support the podcast financially, we do have a Kickstarter, not a Kickstarter, we have a Patreon at patreon.com/doubledocmd, where we release bonus episodes. Once a month, we release a bonus episode, and they are released publicly 1 year later. So we've just done one on Iron Man, and we have another one coming up is, do you remember what we're doing, Annie?
Isn't it Avatar? I think it's Avatar.
I think it is John Cameron's Avatar. I think that is the next one we're doing. Yeah. So that'll be out. In February. Mm-hmm. Well, this episode's coming out in February. It might already be out by the time we get to this one. I'm not good at these. But thank you guys so much. We love you all. Have a good one, all right? Bye-bye.
Bye.
Later.
Oh, also, our intro music, as always, is Troubled by Yourself Factor. Just find a link to their EP in the description. Bye-bye. For real this time. Like